The victims were found in a rural area east of the northern Mexico border city of Matamoros.
And kidnapped by cartel gunmen were taken to a hospital.
As a matter of fact, we had a pastor tell us that there are kidnappings, hundreds of kidnappings on the Mexican side all the time.
After gunmen moved them to multiple locations to avoid capture.
The attention of the American media. So it's one of those things.
It shows the moment when they were kidnapped at gunpoint after being caught in a shootout between rival cartel gangs.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you all so much for listening, and this is going to be a hell of a story. I think this is the first time I'm going to put a positive spin on a sin, wrath. You know the saying, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned? How about hell hath no fury like a mother scorned? The wrath of a parent, specifically a mother, can be otherworldly. But in our case today, Miriam Rodriguez did it with an air of forgiveness, grace, and that forgiveness and grace helped lead her to the place where her daughter's remains were found. This is the story of a woman's solitary mission to avenge her daughter's death. A 54-year-old mother who went toe-to-toe with the cartel, stalking and hunting them across Mexico. This is the heartbreaking and floor-thumping story of Miriam Rodriguez and her daughter Karen, her family, and the fight a mother will take to take care and get justice for her child. And this is a story you can't miss. I feel incredibly inspired by this woman and re-inspired to keep digging into Amanda Winkowski's case because I believe that Leslie has the same heart and fighting spirit as Mrs. Rodriguez. And I've been committed to helping her in her fight. We're not going to hear more about Amanda today, but you'll be hearing more very soon. Especially since I've learned a few tips from this incredible case and this incredible woman today. And today's story is completely because of the diligent and brilliant work of New York Times writer and author Azam Ahmed. I read much of his book, Fear is Just a Word, and all of his New York Times articles about Miriam Rodriguez. Actually, I should say that this whole case is essentially mostly because of Miriam Rodriguez, but Azam Ahmed did the brave work of not just her case, but several cases across Mexico and Latin America. So most of this research is from his book, Fear is Just a Word, his New York Times articles. There are a few other sources like The Guardian and Daily Mail, but I'm pretty sure Azam is the foremost expert on this case. And I encourage you to read his book if you want to dig deeper into this story. Because this story is of a brave mother, but also a story of out-of-control violence, massacres committed by the cartel. And it is also a story of poverty and desperation and political corruption in the northern part of Mexico and southern Texas. So I encourage you to read his book, but really read anything by Azam, who's been up for the Pulitzer Prize, and he won the James Foley Medal for Courage in Journalism for his investigations of gang murder across Latin America. I mean, in Mexico and Honduras, he witnessed shootouts and cartel killings. In Brazil, he tracked down police officers who were members of illegal death squads and persuaded them not to just talk, but also to confess to murders and other crimes. And after 9 members of a Mormon family were killed in remote Mexican mountains, he traveled to the scene and discovered evidence that had been overlooked, including spent shell casings and a child's shoe, going above and beyond what the authorities had done. Greg? Mom, if you're listening, you don't listen because it scares you. Dad, could I please be let off my leash a little more? I seriously want to travel and report on stuff like this. Listen, just because I'm a girl and I do risky things like trespass on cult compounds one time doesn't mean that I can't be like Azam. What I'm trying to say is he's kind of my hero, and I would like to do what he does, but Back to the story. San Fernando, a relatively small town in proportion to the unbelievable violence it holds within its city limits. The larger municipality or area in which San Fernando sits is about 60,000 people, located in the Mexican state of Tamaulipas. But San Fernando itself is just under 30,000 people. And San Fernando is home to some of the most horrific cartel massacres in Mexico history. But the violence isn't just with the cartels. The Mexican government launched a military campaign to fight the war on drugs in 2006. Even despite the fact that the Mexican government had formally colluded with the cartel and used them as protection and political influence, making it possible for the cartels to weasel their way into the professional ranks of the government in Mexico. The military are more respected than the cartel, and their violence, sometimes also as brutal and in broad daylight, is seen as an unavoidable and welcome evil in this fight. The military fought the cartel fought back, the cartel fought each other, and the citizens were doing their best just to exist amongst the chaos and hope not to become one of the unlucky ones in a fight they never wanted to join. And meanwhile, the cartel running this brutal, theatrical horror show that's on display for the locals to see are the Zetas. They took over San Fernando and the greater Tamaulipas area in 2010. Beheadings, torture, and indiscriminate murder committed by the Zetas are on display along the roadside like sadistic badges of honor. It seems almost everyone at least knows someone who has been kidnapped. Sometimes multiple members of one family have been kidnapped over the years. The kidnappings became so rampant that banks started branches of their own lending systems specifically for families to pull out lines of credit in order to pay ransoms. Their over-the-top, unnecessary violence includes shock and awe tactics. While primarily concerned with drug trafficking, the organization also runs profitable sex and gun rackets. The Zetas also operate through protection rackets, assassinations, extortion, kidnappings, and other illegal activities. The Zetas date back to the late 1990s, when commandos of the Mexican army deserted their ranks and began working as the enforcement arm of the Gulf cartel. And then in February 2010, the Zetas broke away and formed their own criminal organization, rivaling the Gulf cartel, rivaling the Sinaloa cartel. In Azam's writing, he says, quote, "The Zetas had pioneered murder as messaging in Mexico, and there was arguably nowhere more deformed by their innovative cruelty than San Fernando, which had the geographic misfortune of lying at the nexus of several highways into the United States." So while the dangers are known, people still have to live their lives. And in Miriam and her husband's case, they had reason to stay in the small town of San Fernando. A business. Compared to many in northeastern Mexico, Miriam Rodriguez and her husband Luis and her three children, her son Luis and her two daughters Azalea and her youngest Karen, lived comfortably. Miriam and her husband ran a cowboy apparel shop, Rodeo Boots. It was small, but it worked. Miriam would also go over the border to nanny for a family in Texas. So on top of owning their own small business, they were also very generous when they could be to those that were not as comfortable as they were. They were not rich by any means, but they were better off than some. Better off than many, perhaps. Luis and Azalea, Karen's older siblings, were grown and out of the house. And Luis had moved to Ciudad Victoria to get away from the violence and start his own small shop. But Karen stayed and lived at home. She was 20 and she wanted to finish school and help run her parents' small cowboy apparel shop. On the night of January 23rd, 2014, Karen left work at the shop, stopped at an intersection about to merge into traffic, when two vehicles pulled up on each side of her, blocking her. And in a flash, armed men forced their way into the family truck she had been driving. They then drive her to her family home. The fact that they must have known no one was home at the time makes me think that they had followed and planned this for a while. Miriam was over the border in Texas at her nannying job, and it's unclear where the father was, but Karen was taken to her family home and tied up. She was bound and gagged, laying on the living room floor, when a knock at the door came. It was her uncle's mechanic, who had stopped by to fix a car owned by the family. Initially, the cartel also tied him up, kidnapped him, but for whatever reason, they ended up letting him go later. And thankfully, they did, because this is how Miriam is able to learn exactly what happened to her daughter. And this is just conjecture, but it seems to me that perhaps Karen and the Rodriguez family were targeted because they owned a business and a town of, you know, less than 30,000. You know, it's not that hard to kind of know who might have more money than others, even though they didn't have a lot, but they were probably more well off than others. So after the horrific kidnapping, Azalea, Miriam's oldest daughter, calls her at a time no mom wants to receive a call with words no mother wants to hear. They came through the telephone at 4 a.m. Azalea is sobbing. And Miriam asks what happened. Something awful, Azalea says. With Karen. Miriam likely knew what this awful could be. The cartel was out there and touched almost every part of the life in San Fernando. It almost feels like it's a matter of time until your family faces their wrath and greed. She knew. Without even thinking, she packed her bags and left the family a note, quitting her job for good. She had to save her baby. She loved caring for their child, but her child needed her and needed all of her. So she left her nannying job and she rushed towards the international bridge connecting Texas and Mexico and waited painfully anxious for the bus to take her to San Fernando. On that bus, an older man took kindness on her and saw the pained, silently crying woman and offered her his handkerchief and asked her what was wrong. The normally put together, always looking glamorous for any occasion, and likely fairly reserved in showing signs of weakness woman, gave it to the man straight up. Miriam said her daughter had been kidnapped by the Zeta cartel. The old man, silent and steady, more than aware of these dangers, wrote a note on a piece of paper he pulled from his jacket. "That is my son. His name is Alex. He's a lieutenant in the Marines. Call him. He can help." Miriam took the man's kind gesture and tucked it away, perhaps not thinking she'd ever use it. After all, her son Luis, trying to calm the family down once Miriam arrived after her two-hour bus trip, said the Zetas are businessmen. They have no reason to go back on their deal. They want money. That's their goal, essentially. Now, I'm not using the exact words, obviously, and I don't want to use the words Azam used, but it seems that he was trying to have hope beyond hope that the family wasn't making deals with the devil. They were fulfilling a business transaction. And so they did. Azalea picked up Miriam from the bus station, and before Miriam could even settle into the car, her phone rang. It was Karen's kidnappers. And Karen. The kidnapper hushed Miriam. He was going to give her his demands, and she would remain quiet. And then Karen came on the phone. And in a very rehearsed tone only a mother could recognize, Karen spoke. Miriam started to say, "Are you okay?" Her voice cracking. "Have they done anything to you? Have they hurt you?" Then Karen says, "Mom, please let me talk." She shouted, "This is about money. Please, just get together whatever you can." The exact same rehearsed line that Karen had said to her father hours earlier when the kidnappers had called him. Azalea was able to confirm this. She was there. And as quickly as the call started, the kidnappers abruptly hung up, right when Karen finished her lines. Miriam's stomach sank. She wailed and sobbed like never before. But they did the only thing they could do in that moment. Come up with the money. Save their baby. And maybe her son Luis was right. They were just business people, and money is what they wanted. She prayed and hoped to God that that was it. So they headed to the bank. Luis, Miriam's husband, had good credit and a good standing in the town, being known for owning a small business for over 20 years, and they were quickly able to lend him the money for the ransom. Along with that loan, the family pooled together their life savings, and altogether, it was a little less than $10,000. Luis, Karen's father, met them outside a health center as instructed by the cartel. When Luis went to hand him the bag of cash, he kept his grip while painfully asking where his daughter was. The young man indicated she would be delivered and released at the cemetery site, which was the next instructed place to meet. So Miriam and her husband, Luis, went, and they waited and waited. No one ever showed. Their daughter being the obvious most important person to see, but they saw no one. And 2 days later, 54-year-old Miriam would meet with one of the main foot soldiers for the cartel alone. She would not be afraid. She would get her daughter back. She met them at El Junior restaurant. She sat across from two young men, one whose face and name would become imprinted on her brain. He was tall and thin, curly hair, light skin. And the other was a young man who might have still been in his teens, with big, bulging eyes and clearly hungry, or trying to intimidate Miriam. He asked her if she was going to finish her sandwich, as it had been sitting there untouched, and Miriam pushed the plate towards him as he ate her food and his commander negotiated her daughter's life. The man, who never gave his name, tells Miriam the Zetas are not responsible, but he can help her figure out who is, for a fee of $2,000. But he also flip-flops, making Miriam distrust him. If the Zetas aren't involved, then why is he telling her that Karen has been very easy to deal with, which is why he wants to return her? But she still pays the $2,000, even though nothing is making sense, nothing is adding up. But by one grace from God, she gets some information. His name. Toward the end of the meeting, Miriam can faintly hear the conversation this man is having on his walkie-talkie. And through the static, she hears the man on the other end call him by his first name, Sama. Over the next week, Sama's communication with her drops. He initially fake updates her on his hunt, but eventually stops answering the phone altogether. There were more demands and calls, and the family met every single one of them until exactly 1 month after Karen was kidnapped. Miriam gathers herself together. She was always a woman that presented herself meticulously to the world. She had pride, she had confidence, and perhaps she needed to harness that in order to do what she does next for the next 3 years. So Miriam gets off the couch, goes upstairs, and brushes her hair for the first time in what feels like weeks. She takes a bath, applies her makeup, puts on her jewelry, and walks downstairs. And as matter of fact as a soldier going to war, she says to her daughter, Karen is not coming home. Not in the way, at least, we want her to. She told Azalea that she would not rest until she finds the people who had taken Karen. She would hunt them down, one by one, until the day she died. She began to compile a list. Some of the members were in prison, not for the kidnapping of her daughter, but some were also dead, killed in other cartel fights, and some had tried to break bad of sorts and go back to prior jobs, one even becoming a born-again Christian. But her hunt was on. She dyed her hair bright red and cut it short, so when she encountered Sama or anyone who knew her, they would not recognize her. She begins her meticulous stalking of these men and women. She said, quote, I'm going to find the people who did this to my daughter, and I'm going to make them pay. She left the house, jumped into her husband's truck, and called the number that elderly man gave her a month prior on the bus. Lieutenant Alex. Making contact with anyone who could help. And then something strange and serendipitous, but ultimately also horrifying, happened. Weeks later, while driving through the central plaza of San Fernando, she noticed two girls on a bench using a laptop. The girls were not familiar, but the laptop was. It was her daughter, Karen's. She called Alex the Marine, while keeping watch of the girls, making sure they didn't leave. The two girls were in their 20s, most likely, one almost blonde and one with dark hair. Their names were Jessica and Margarita. And this exchange and discovery of these two girls would show Miriam the Marines are as ruthless and decisive as the cartel, just in a different way. They were almost vigilantes like her, but Miriam didn't kill ruthlessly. She wanted to track these men and women down, but she did not want to be a part of this violence. Still, Miriam had convinced Alex that these two girls had to know something. How else would they have her daughter's laptop? So the Marines came and they grabbed the two girls from the plaza. And Miriam would be a part of the raid that happened next. Her husband dropped her off in a field while she waited for the Marines to pick her up. She would put on a Marine uniform in order to go undetected. She made sure to be there on that raid of the ranch, not too far from her own home. The Marines allowed it. But the Zetas needed to not recognize her, thus the uniform, and the Marines told Miriam she needed to know that this is going to be a dangerous mission. The Marines had Jessica and Margarita in tow, the two girls from the plaza, when they picked Miriam up. Miriam didn't ask how they found the location of the ranch, but maybe assumed they scared the girls enough to give it up, or perhaps worse. When they got out of the vehicle, they all made the trudge through the ranch land. And that trudge was like a scene from a horror movie. A noose hung from a tree. A tractor marked where bodies had been buried. Bone shards were visible with the naked eye. And then suddenly the Marines were yelling. Miriam could hear the sharp pop of incoming fire. The Zetas were shooting at them. According to Azam's article, the Marines responded swiftly, firing with precision as several of the Zetas fled into the woods beyond the ranch. By the time the firefight ended, four bodies lay strewn in the tall grass, scattered between the ranch's structures and the trees on the property. Three men and one woman. As they scanned the property, the Marines found a few kidnapping victims still alive. One was babbling incoherently about how a female Zeta was preparing to cut off his head when the rain began. Miriam walked among them in disguise, searching. These innocent lives were saved by this raid. Her raid. And none of them was Karen. There were IDs tossed everywhere, lanyards with photos of employees and government licenses? Had they all died or were some returned home? Miriam then made a grim discovery. A stack of items she'd ruffled through contained a scarf of Karen's and the seat cushion from their truck. She kept those details to herself, though, but the horror of the night was not over. After the Marines discovered the kidnapping victims, the living ones, they began finding the remains of others long since murdered, including the bodies of three women. One of them was pregnant, according to Azam's article. Incensed, the Marines threw Margarita and Jessica to the ground and asked them about the dead women. They told the Marines that they had snatched the women from the highway and then killed them after their families failed to pay their ransom. According to Azam's article, the Marines listened quietly to the explanation, and when the women finished confessing, the Marines forced Jessica to her knees and killed her on the spot. They then told Margarita to run. "If you can make it to the tree line, you're free," one of the Marines said. Margarita took off in a sprint, heading towards the forest at the edge of the ranch. The Marines, meanwhile, took their time, lining up a clean shot. According to the government autopsy reports conducted the following day, four of the assailants died from multiple gunshot wounds to the chest and abdomen. A fifth victim, a woman, carried a single round that entered near the front of her clavicle and exited from her lower back, as she would have been made to kneel before being executed. And the sixth victim, also a woman, was the only individual to die from gunshot wounds to the back. End quote. Miriam, while simultaneously heartbroken to find more evidence of her daughter's likely demise, was grateful to the Marines while also saddened by the violence and killing of the two girls, but not deterred in her own fight. Next on her list was Sama. Miriam needed to track him down. She first scoured her daughter's social media to see if Sama was a person her daughter knew. She couldn't find him. She's pulling all-nighters at this point, searching, and knowing that Sama or someone would eventually post a photo. So after searching for forever, she's lying on the couch, taking a much-needed rest. And while scrolling through Facebook, knowing he will show up, a miracle happens. Sama's name popped up, tagged in a photo with a girl wearing an ice cream shop uniform. She searches the name of the business from the uniform and finds it's located 2 hours away in Ciudad Victoria, the same town her son Luis also lives in. And this will become an important part to this story. So she drives the 2 hours there, and she basically camps out, memorizing this girl's working hours, waiting for someone to show up. And after weeks, he does. When Sama finally picks up his girlfriend from the ice cream shop, Miriam followed them back to the neighborhood in which they lived, marked the address, and then went to work. She then grabbed her old uniform for when she worked at a public health facility, made a fake government badge, and began conducting polls through the neighborhood. Under the guise of an official government duty, gaining information on Karen's kidnappers. Eventually, she gets Sama's last name and everything she needs from his neighbors. Everyone in that neighborhood didn't know they were in on her genius plan. She goes to the authorities, knowing that it's probably going to be an ill-fated attempt because the cartel are in the pockets of the authorities and vice versa. But she does find one man who says he considers it his greatest honor of his career to help her. He remained anonymous in the articles, but he was so impressed by her and again considers it his greatest honor. So after she went to the state, local, police, whatever, they all ignored her. But one man in the federal police, specifically this man, was so impressed with her file of work and that she had done this all on her own, he wanted to help. Meanwhile, word gets back to Sama that someone's been asking questions about him, so he flees at this point. But Miriam isn't worried. She has information now on his associates, him, all of her boots on the ground investigating is paying off. She will find him, and she won't rest until she does. And then she gets another lucky break. You see, her son lives in Ciudad Victoria, and she had obviously kept him abreast of what Sama looked like and that he had skipped town from San Fernando and that his girlfriend also worked in Ciudad Victoria. Armed with this knowledge, Luis spots him. So Luis is closing up his shop in Ciudad Victoria when one lingering customer looks familiar. And that lingering customer was Sama. Bullseye. So Luis follows him very discreetly and then calls his mom. This is a family of fucking badasses, by the way. But Miriam then alerts the police, doing the right thing because she's a good fucking person and, you know, not trying to just kill him. She finds his location, tells the police, and they corner him in the plaza. While Sama, while being arrested, tries to fake a heart condition. But the police call bullshit and they arrest him anyway. Then Sama sings like a bird and gives up the name of others involved. And one of those was a kid named Christian Gonzalez, an 18-year-old boy. So Miriam goes to the station when Christian is set to be interrogated. And she's watching and listening outside the interrogation room. And this is perhaps one of the most heart-wrenching or heartwarming parts of this story. It's really hard to know because this story is so much. But when she's watching this 18-year-old boy being interrogated, at one point he asked for his mom and said he was hungry. And Miriam overheard this, and she came into the interrogation room and she gave the boy her own lunch, which was a piece of fried chicken, and then she went and bought him a Coke. Perplexed by this, detectives and her friend also, who came with her to the station, asked her why they were surprised by her kindness. And she said, "He is still a child no matter what he did, and I am still a mother." The boy then, perhaps touched by her kindness, gave up the names, confessed to everything, and said he was willing to take them to the ranch where the bodies were buried. The ranch was the same one where that raid happened prior. When leaving the ranch, Miriam realizes that there's a barbecue restaurant just outside the ranch where she had eaten with her daughter Azalea just 2 days after Karen's kidnapping. And she remembered seeing a young girl that she recognized from that girl's childhood named Elvia Betancourt. At the time, she recognized the young girl sipping a Coke, just sitting there, and she asked her if she had heard anything about Karen. But Elvia played dumb. And in hindsight now, this was odd, especially since Miriam knew this girl as a kid. She used to actually even give this little girl Karen's old clothes. You see, Elvia was abandoned at a brothel by her mother, who was a sex worker, and Miriam took pity on her and knew this little girl well. But as this now young adult was sitting there, sipping a drink, just telling her, "I know nothing about Karen," on the second drive past the barbecue restaurant, it dawned on Miriam that this girl might be watching over the ranch while the boys are out doing whatever they're doing, committing murders, committing crimes, that she might be involved and watching the ranch in case the police came. And she was right. And Miriam was not going to let the pity that she had on this child at a certain point stop her from getting justice for her own daughter. I mean, she gave her Karen's clothes. She tried to help her. And what a slap in the face this was. All right, surprise, it's going to be a part two because Miriam tracks down more than just the people I've mentioned now. And you'll find out how she gets this girl arrested the florist, and more in part two on the incredible story, incredible and heartbreaking story of Miriam Rodriguez, her daughter Karen, her husband Luis, her son Luis, her daughter Azalea, the fight that this family had, but specifically the fight that a mother had, a middle-aged woman that went toe-to-toe with the cartel. All right, I'll see you guys next week. Love you. Thank you for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thank you. Bye.